Who misses free and affordable ads and social networks without the anti-sex work rhetoric? Assembly 4 is a team of sex workers and technologists in Melbourne, Australia, aiming to bring back free and fair advertising and social spaces to the sex working community. They also give back to organizations based in harm reduction, sex work, and education. Stepping away from the clunky design of traditional platforms, their two products, Tryst.link and Switter.at, are refreshing and well-needed changes in both presentation and mission. Both are free to join and open to all. In the words of an A4 user, from the policies to the language to the advice and tips, it makes such a big difference to feel encouraged and supported instead of policed. Check out their website, assembly4.com, for the word and not the number, for more info. Welcome to the Peep Show Podcast.
News and stories from the sex industry.
With Jesse and PJ Sage. Welcome back to another episode of the Peep Show Podcast. This week I have Juniper Fitzgerald with me. We talk about our essays on sex work and motherhood in the New Feminist Press anthology, We Too, Essays on Sex Work and Survival. Is there enough kink and flirtation in your life right now? Aorta Films creates lusty, opulent, glorious fuckery. Their films are full of beautifully shot, super hot queer porn featuring a large range of bodies, identities, kinks, and dynamics. This month, check out Aorta's newest release, Hard at Work, featuring Indigo and Zay Royale. Working from home has its perks, so when Zay Royale finds Indigo working overtime, they decide to take matters, and Indigo's dick, into their own hands. Shot during the pandemic, this at-home short featuring IRL partners buzzes with electric, intimate energy. $9 a month on Patreon gets you full access to Aorta's library of 60-plus short and featured films, with a new film released on the first of each month. Or back them at the $17 a month level, and you get a download of that month's film delivered straight to your inbox. Welcome back. I am really excited for today's episode. I have Juniper Fitzgerald on, and we're going to talk about our essays that are in We Too, the new anthology that's edited by Tina Horn and Natalie West that came out this week. So that is very exciting. We also talk about motherhood and string theory and the X-Files and Gillian Anderson and stripper poles and all sorts of things. So it's going to be a fun episode. I am a little tired right now because I just put my little boy on a school bus for the first time ever this morning, and I couldn't sleep last night. I was like so nervous for him, but he just got like right on the bus. Like it was no big deal. Like he did it every day. So I don't know. Maybe I didn't need to stay up all night, but here we are. I can't help myself. Before we get into the episode, I wanted to do a little housekeeping. I first wanted to talk about the fact that I so appreciate all of the new patrons this month. We had a really good month on Patreon, and it shows that you all are appreciating what we're doing, which I can't even tell you how happy I am about that, because we work so hard here to give you guys really good content that we think that you'll like. So having people sign up for Patreon and support us in the ways that you do is really meaningful. I wanted to give a special shout out to the people who are contributing at $50 a month. And there's two of them. There's Frankie Rivers, a great content creator that you all should check out. And Aubrey Hayes and Liara Rue, who you should also check out. So we are really super grateful to them, and then also to all of the other Patreons who are keeping us going. Running a podcast and running our site that we run is a lot of labor. All of these episodes take a ton of time and energy, a lot of editing skills. And not only that, but we also have to like advertise it. Courtney Trouble and our intern Liz do a great job of that. We're spending a lot of time recruiting people to be on the podcast, also trying to get sponsors. So like, please, you know, if you can contribute to our Patreon, we really appreciate it. And just kind of keeps things running here at Peep Show Podcast, because we love what we're doing and we want to continue to do it. So huge shout out to Frankie Rivers and to Aubrey Hayes and Liara Rue. We appreciate you very much. I also wanted to talk about a couple of other things coming up. On February 12th, we are going to have our next Peep Show Live, and we have a special Valentine's Day thing. So PJ and I are actually going to be guests. We're not going to be hosts. The hosts are going to be our intern Liz and Courtney Trouble, and they are going to do a great job. And we're going to be talking about couples in the porn industry or in the sex industry. So we have a couple of we have three lovely industry couples, and I will announce who they are soon, but it's going to be great. So save the date, February 12th, 8:30 p.m., Eastern Standard Time. The last thing that I want to say is that if you haven't already, please buy Feminist Press We Too, Essays in Sex Work and Survival. We're going to be talking a little bit about that today, but it is an amazing compilation of sex work writers. Man, when I got this in the mail and I saw my name among all of these other sex workers that I admire so much, I was like kind of starstruck, I'm not going to lie. Like a lot of people who've been on the show actually are in the book, but so many other people, Ashley Page, Lorelei Lee, Thought Scholar, Femi Babylon, oh my gosh, Juniper, obviously, Arabelle Raphael, Maggie McMuffin, Reese Piper, just Audacia Ray, on and on and on, like really, really amazing writers. So you should check that out. If I were you, I would buy it directly from Feminist Press. Other than that, I don't have any announcements right now. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hey, I'm Adrian, one of the hosts of After Adult Podcast. My porn name should be Mozart Fremont, but you probably know me better by my actual porn name, Siri.
I'm Rachel, but my porn name would be Woody 16th Avenue.
After Adult is a podcast about life and porn.
I don't actually watch porn.
I don't really watch that much porn either. I probably watch more than you, but I mean, most of the time it kind of would feel like going to work on my day off.
You 100% watch more than me, because I don't watch porn. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for After Adult.
Or visit afteradult.com and follow us on Instagram at afteradult.
I'm here with Juniper Fitzgerald, who is a mama, writer, and radical in the Midwest. She's the author of the first children's book featuring a sex-working mother, How Mamas Love Their Babies, as well as the forthcoming auto theory on sex work, motherhood, and narrative. So welcome, Juniper.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you again. It's been a while.
It has been a long time. And it's so funny when you read my bio, I guess I'm like, I hope I'm a radical anyway.
I'm pretty sure you are. It's hard. We get like, well, you know, the fact that none of us have left our house in like a year makes us wonder about that.
I know. Totally. I don't know what's real anymore.
I know. My son was talking to me about that yesterday and I was like, I don't know. I used to think there was like a world outside of our house and family. And now, you know, I'm not so sure.
I know. My child, so she's been getting into like string theory.
Really?
I know. Isn't that wild? So yeah. She's obsessed with this idea that that there are multiple timelines and that in one timeline, she's the mom and she makes the rules.
Oh, how convenient.
I know.
That's interesting. How'd she get into that?
You know, this precocious kid, most of the time I look at her and I'm like, how did you come from my body? I don't understand. Like, I'm pretty sure by the time I was 6 years old, I was smoking cigarettes and drinking whiskey. But
she, probably not six.
I don't know. But she like found this video on this physicist or like string theorist guy named Brian Green. And
yeah, I know who that is.
Oh, do you know who that is?
Yeah. Yeah. I actually wrote a master's thesis on special relativity theory. Nah. And like, yeah, nah. I'm not a science person. I don't really know why I did that. I was doing a theology degree and I got obsessed with this idea of whether like, if there was a God, if God could be inside of time or outside of time and what that would mean. So I spent like a couple of years of my life looking at different models of time.
That is fucking amazing. And do you know what else I love about this? So Scully in the X-Files, her PhD dissertation is on relativity, and my next book that's coming out is basically all about the X-Files.
Really?
Yes.
I remember talking about the X-Files with you, but I did not know that that's what her dissertation was on.
Yes, you're like Scully.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment because she's kind of an icon.
Yeah, she's the hottest thing that's ever lived, actually.
You know, I've never watched The X-Files.
I mean, you know, watching it now as an almost 40-year-old self-proclaimed radical, I'm like, oh, wow, this is a story about cops. But
yeah,
so that's, you know.
Yeah.
That's not good. But just thinking about the 90s, I don't know if you had the opportunity to watch Promising Young Woman.
No.
Oh, my God.
So, I see people tweet about it all the time, though. Is it worth watching?
I really, really loved it. And the set director, whatever you call them, for Promising Young Woman was the same person who did the set design for Sweet Valley High.
And, oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's supposed to be kind of this radical critique of like 90s, you know, the kind of promises of girl power and shit like that of the 90s. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I think of when I think of Scully and the X-Files. Like, we had never seen anything like Scully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 90s. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be critiquing it now because that show was
sure.
So problematic.
Yeah. You know, I had my, this is going to sound like a weird thing to say, but we watched Dirty Dancing the other day because my kid and my husband were like, I've never seen Dirty Dancing. And I'm like, what? How can that be? How have you guys never seen this movie? Because I swear my little sister and I watched it, you know, I mean, I was born in the 70s. So I grew up in the 80s and we watched it like a bajillion times when we were growing up and like thought it was so, you know, scandalous and interesting. And I like to watch the dancing. So I was like, well, you guys are going to watch this with me. And we watched it. And I was thinking about the fact that like, sometimes things that are like that we remember don't, I don't know. I could tell that my kid was like, what is this? Like, I think he read it as like cheesy, where to me it seemed like radical when I watched it.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's kind of the promise of nostalgia, right? And like how mm-hmm. it's always a false promise. And that's, I mean, I'm super interested in these narratives that we tell and how they change over the course of a life. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, it's so interesting to think about whether God exists inside or outside of time, but like how that might parallel questions of narrative. Like what does it mean to look mm-hmm. back on a narrative you had or look back with nostalgic eyes on something?
I think those are really interesting questions because the whole idea of like God standing inside or outside of time is how much can we perceive like at once, right? So
yeah.
the whole idea of like a space-time block would be, you know, that it would mean that if you could get outside of it, you could like see the totality of the temporal order like all at once, you know? And so what would that mean for nostalgia? And like, why is that idea even interesting, you know?
And nostalgia, I mean, nostalgia only happens because of our perception of time moving linearly, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You only have nostalgia because you're looking back.
Yeah.
But I've heard people describe that, like, in some places in the universe, there might be time is, like, more of a physical thing. Like, you could step into the future and then step out of it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of like theorists who came out of like going back to the special relativity theory who would talk about the fact that like past, present, and future you could think about as like having equal status as like points in this kind of spatio-temporal framework, you know, just as like up and down have points, like geographical points, like time could also be conceptualized like that. And that's really interesting to me.
It's super interesting. And, it, you know, coming out of 2020 and having a shit ton of grief around a whole mm-hmm. lot of things.
Yeah.
It really makes me think about grief, too. I mean, if the past, present, and future are kind of just these points, I mean, rather than this linear thing, what does it mean to be grieving in this moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but also, like, subjectively, like, you know, things feel different over time. Things that were, like, very intense at one point in time, and I think, like, we feel this sort of intensity now coming out of this year, like, at some point, we'll feel like the past. You know, I think about this a lot with my kids because they're, you know, one's in high school and one's like a young adult, and they're experiencing, you know, 2020 at these like really intense moments of their life. Like, you know, 15 and 18 are intense moments of everybody's lives, but their lives are particularly impacted in this way that will change a lot of their, I don't know, I think it'll change the course of like how they think about things. And, you know, but at some point they're going to be telling a story about what happened this year. And to people who can't remember it, my little one isn't going to remember this, you know, and that's so weird.
Time is a weird thing. I think we've all experienced at least just the weirdness of it in 2020. Like, yeah. What day is it? Has it been a year or like years?
Yeah. Or even like, remember that time that we used to, you know, go places and see other people, not just on our computers. It's like a very weird thing.
It is so strange.
Yeah. And I don't know. It's also become like normalized in a way that's also weird.
You know, I remember, so right before lockdown, we were, my child and I were off the grid. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was reading these news stories that were coming in, and I remember thinking, I wonder when, like, I knew that it was about, like, shit was about to get real. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, I wonder how long it will take for it to feel normal.
Yeah. Was it less than you thought?
I guess as a sociologist, it made sense to me, but it is, I mean, it's wild to me as just an individual person, not looking yeah. through my sociological lens, to see how quickly humans adapt to really fucked up shit. Like, oh my God, that was really quite quick.
Yeah. You know what I thought was weird about, I mean, not about the political, I mean, and this is political too, but about the pandemic in particular, is that, do you remember the like very intense sort of like fear, which was totally rational and reasonable? I'm not saying like, you know, that there was in like March and April, and then in like November and December, numbers were even higher and everybody had kind of lost interest in yes. it.
And like schools were opening back up.
Mm-hmm.
Humans, I think, forget what a collective kind of species we are. You know, yeah. it's like even our mentality or sense about things is collective.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good way to put it, I think. Yeah. And we kind of like pick up the vibe and the energy of the people around us.
Yeah. And we're like, oh, nobody's freaking out. May as well open up the schools.
Well, this was like a very abstract and heady opening.
I love it.
No, that's what you get when you put us together. Like, let's try to reconceptualize the notion of time in the first 10 minutes of the show.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so how have you been?
I've been okay. I mean, you know, it's been a really hard year for all of us. In every possible way, it's been difficult. Mm-hmm. As you know, there was some family stuff. My family member shot and killed a Black Lives Matter protester. James Scurlock was his name.
Yeah.
And so that was very troubling. And
What's the status of that right now? What's happening with your family member?
So that particular family member is now deceased.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. So it's just been a challenge.
Yeah. And
it's wild to be in a city where I like no longer have any family. I mean, it's, you know, being disowned by my family was a long time coming.
Yeah.
But it's wild to be in the same city, especially a small place like where I live. Mm.
Do you live in your, like, where you grew up?
I do.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. I didn't know if you were there for a job or if that's where you actually grew up.
I grew up here in a little Midwestern city.
I actually kind of want to ask you about this because, I mean, we live in the Midwest too, technically. And I'm curious, like, what you think about switching gears to, like, sex work, which we're going to get into, I think. Or what do you notice about the difference between, like, doing sex work activism or writing or stuff like that from the Midwest than one of the coastal cities? Like, do you feel like your experiences are different? I'm being inarticulate now, but what I mean to say is that, like, a lot of the sex work writing and sex work activism is coming out of, like, the coastal cities and not the Midwest. But there are, like, you know, a handful of us, you know, here. Do you feel like it's a different experience?
I love that question. Yeah. I mean, it's totally different. I had this gig through CNN for like a week. and I wanted to get, and it seems, I mean, for anybody watching Peep Show podcasts, this will seem very simplistic, but I wanted to get just people, you know, sex workers talking about why sex workers' rights are important to them.
Yeah.
And this random person commented on my Twitter something like yawn, like as if this hasn't been done a million times, and it's like, yeah, on the coast,
wow,
you know, yeah, like, talking about sex workers' rights is truly novel in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I'm in progressive feminist groups, like private Facebook groups, and the idea that sex work is something different than sex trafficking truly is a new conversation that's just happening here.
Yeah.
And largely due to young people. Like, young people are so cool.
I know. That's so true.
Aren't they so awesome?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's way different. I mean, people don't even, I remember growing up here and joking that we were 10 years behind everybody else in the United States. And I think that's true of sex workers' rights too. People are yeah. literally just hearing about it. And I hope I'm doing my city justice. I don't mean to suggest that people are, you know, willfully ignorant or anything like that. It's just that the circumstances of living in the Midwest do not lend themselves to open conversations about sex at all. First of all.
Yeah. So, right.
Sex workers' rights is
you know. So far beyond just talking about sex. Yeah. I mean, I hear that. I'm from a coast. I'm from California, and I moved to Pittsburgh from the Bay Area. And I've been here for so long now that I might as well be from the Midwest. But I remember moving here, and I wasn't a sex worker at the time. But what I remember so strongly is going to initial job interviews when I first moved here and like thinking, oh, well, I'm here now. I got to find a job. And I remember going to job interviews and having them ask me if I had kids and then telling me, oh, well, this is a very demanding job. It's not right for a mom. And thinking to myself, like, wait, what? Like, isn't that illegal? They can't ask me that. But having things like that happen over and over again, where it was just, I was totally like shell-shocked that kind of blatant just discrimination based on gender and motherhood was like still happening. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, 15 years ago when I moved here, that's where we were. And so to, you know, to even talk about moms, just any moms having like a job that's a full-time job that requires travel is like, that was an issue then. And so like to move to sex worker rights, that's, you know, way beyond.
And you're in a much more progressive place. Like I am in the heart of the United States surrounded by corn. And but I do think that, I mean, I remember being part of, and still am part of the queer rights movement in the, you know, begin. I mean, I think my first gay pride parade is what we used to call them anyway. Late 80s or early 90s. And I mean, I feel like that movement is following a very similar trajectory as the sex rights movement. And even some of the same discourse that's been used to kind of invalidate the queer rights movement is being used against the sex workers' right movement now. And I find that terribly interesting. Like these kind of clay, like these really like vile and boisterous claims of like pedophilia and shit like that. I mean, yeah. I remember people saying the same thing about queer people.
Yeah.
In the early 90s. So, and that's not to say that sexual abuse, like I'm definitely not one of those sex worker activists that denies that trafficking exists. I definitely acknowledge
that either. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exists. So I don't want to discount the fact that like pedophilia and trafficking happen in every place in the world, in every labor sector, et cetera.
Right.
But I don't want to like downplay the horror of that, but the discourse that sex work activists are somehow apologizing for pedophiles, it's the same discourse that was used for the queer rights movement, that people who wanted queer rights were apologizing for pedophiles. So it's just really interesting to be able to live long enough to see some of this shit recycled.
I'm going to try to draw a parallel, and maybe it's not really necessarily a parallel, but like I was thinking as you were talking that part of the problem with like the discourse around sex worker rights is that sex workers are pushed into having very like, or at least into not having super nuanced views about things because people outside of the sex work community can't have those conversations and don't have like an ability to do that or vocabulary to do that or like a conceptual framework to understand how like complicated something like sex worker, sex workers' experiences are. Yeah. And I was just thinking as you were saying that, like, one of the things that's happened is that most recently with Visa MasterCard pulling out of Pornhub, you suddenly had so many people within, within sex worker communities, particularly performers and porn performers, who were suddenly forced to like defend their right to work on Pornhub, which nobody likes. Like nobody actually likes working on Pornhub, you know? Or likes Pornhub. I mean, some people are making money and, you know, people like making money, but like, and the same thing happened with, you know, Backpage. Suddenly like you have to defend like really difficult things to defend because there's like, because it's better than like the alternatives. And I think that, I don't know, I think it becomes, really complicated.
Well, you know, and as you're saying all of that, it's like, I think that punitive regimes always lend themselves to false binaries, because once you've got this punitive regime that's like destroying the sex worker community and destroying the way that people make money, then, I mean, I do not identify as a sex positive feminist, but I can see why people do. I mean, so the reaction to being systematically destroyed is to be like, no, I'm not oppressed. Like I'm liberated. Right. Work. I love this work. It's sexually liberating, blah, blah, blah. Which I think is true for perhaps some people.
Yeah.
I would say that my experiences are a little more complicated than that, but in any case, you know, anytime you have like a punitive regime, I think it lends itself to these kind of false dichotomies of liberated and exploited and
right and wrong
and
And I mean, I think that's what I was trying to, or that's kind of what I was circling around when I was thinking about what you were saying about, you know, somebody saying, oh, we've already had these conversations. These are very basic conversations. And if you're living within a framework, you know, on one of the coasts where you're surrounded by people who can talk, you know, in a nuanced way about sex workers, then maybe those questions do seem, you know, like simple questions that have been happening for a long time. But for a lot of other people, they haven't even been exposed to any of this. So, you know, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about when I gave birth, right after I gave birth, I flew to San Francisco and made a porn. I remember some of the people that I was making the porn with had already figured out a way for me to be on set, but in a space where I could legally still breastfeed my child. That's so, because there are laws around that, but just the fact, like, that is a conversation that would never happen in Nebraska. Like, nobody is making like, how do we make sex working mothers more comfortable in this phase of sex work? We are at this basic level conversation about the difference between sex work and sex trafficking. And and again, like, even to have that conversation, you have to set up this false dichotomy, because really I want to talk about the gray areas.
Right.
And how we get to have these gray, nuanced, complicated areas that aren't liberating and aren't exploitative.
Right.
But you can't even get there before, you know,
you have to like assert the basic like humanity of sex workers first and get people on that page. And that's actually harder than you would think it is.
Yes, totally.
Like, I would think that would be really easy, but then just because I would think it should be easy to assert the humanity of all people and have them be like, yes, they deserve to not be hurt in their jobs. They deserve to have a way to, safely work and live and thrive. That seems like such a basic principle to me, but it is just not for so many people. And I think about that every time I make it like a little bit out of like the sex work bubble, if I happen to tweet something that goes, you know, slightly viral so that people that aren't sex workers see it. And I'm just barraged with like, yeah, but who cares? Like, they're whores, you know? And I'm like, wow. You know, we assume that people believe that we should be like treated with some amount of empathy, but that's not really what's happening.
There are just so many different ways to kind of branch off of this conversation, but it's, you know, I was actually thinking about this last night. I saw some people posting on Facebook, where I now live most of my life because I've been on lockdown for a year. I saw some people posting on Facebook.
I gave up on Facebook. I quit. But yeah. So I don't know what's happening there. So you'll have to tell me.
Well, I saw some local people posting about their affinities for Bernie Sanders. And I live in Nebraska, and I've been working in, or, you know, started working in the service industry here when I was 14. Like, I know. And so I was just cracking up because some of these people were such horrible customers. Like, I have done every possible thing you can imagine in the service industry, including sex work.
Yeah.
And like, people are fucking assholes. And I think that the kind of lack of empathy for sex workers is at its core a lack of empathy for laborers and the proletariat.
Yeah.
So it's very much class-based and obviously intersectional, you know, with race and ability. Yeah. I think it's that sex workers are considered kind of the lowest on the rung of labor. And yeah. So far down that it's not even considered labor.
Right.
It's right. Like, I don't even know, like an identity to be spat upon.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So why, on that note, let's talk a little bit about the anthology that we both have essays in. So one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you is because we both talked about motherhood and sex work. And I was curious if you wanted to talk a little bit about, and you're also writing a book right now too, that encompasses these themes. If you want to talk a little bit about how you've been thinking about like motherhood and sex work.
Oh, yes. I'm so happy to be in an anthology with you. I opened up the table of contents and I was like, holy shit. How am I in a book with these people?
I know, I thought that too. I was like, this is like the who's who of like sex workers. How did I end up here?
it's lovely to be in your presence. And several other writers that I just respect and
so much. I know. I had that same feeling. Like, they did an amazing job of curating such good writing.
Totally. So I have to give a shout out to Feminist Press because they are amazing. And they've always been supportive of me. You know, they published How Mamas Love Their Babies, the children's book with a sex working mother.
Yeah.
And they're just a wonderful press company. So yeah, check out We too. Buy it right from Feminist Press.
Yeah.
But the way, yeah, so God, I mean, I've thought so many different ways about motherhood and sex work. and you know what I've actually been thinking about a lot lately? And I'm going to not dive into my article for We too much, because I actually get really embarrassed looking at old writing.
I totally get that.
But I was actually thinking about when I first got pregnant and first found out that I was pregnant, I was working with, excuse me, I'm sorry, it's really dry here and we're in a blizzard, so I keep coughing and you probably won't be able to edit out all of it. So I was working with a brothel. I had been hired as a worker and then I got pregnant. And so I was doing writing and I wasn't selling sex, but I was still like working with them pretty regularly with some writing projects and stuff. And the manager of the brothel, I was like, you know, you really should let me work at the brothel because I'd be like your only pregnant lady and it could be super hot. And he said, no, I could, like, I morally couldn't allow that because the only people that would be interested in having sex with a pregnant lady are people who have weird, like, child fetishes.
What?
Yeah. Isn't that wild? So,
yeah.
I keep coming back. So, long story really long. I keep coming back to, I don't know if you've read Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, but
I love that book. Oh, it's my favorite God. Book.
She's so brilliant. She has this quote that's like, the thing about being pregnant is that you're not one, but you're not two. That's kind of like the kind of weird, nuanced, undescribable thing about sex work too. Like,
yeah.
I'm not public, but I'm not private. Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm not a public woman, but I'm not I don't know.
That's really interesting and I think pretty profound. Like, what does it mean to occupy, like, our bodies if we're pregnant or if we're doing sex work or if we use our bodies in ways that, you know, aren't deemed respectable or appropriate or something?
Right. And the way that, like, this brothel manager viewed me was that I was no longer like an autonomous woman. Like I was like the child was the only thing that mattered about my body. Therefore, anybody having sex with me was like ostensibly having sex with a child.
That's bizarre. Like I think that's really bizarre. Like, does he think that like couples like just abstain from having sex the entire time one of them is pregnant?
I mean, it's bizarre to us, but I think a lot of people do think that way, you know, I lived in Las Vegas through my pregnancy and I mean, I would still go out like,
like leave the house and be a human being.
But there was this great casino that had amazing pizza and I would go to this casino and, you know, be my hot little pregnant self and have pizza. And people, you know, people come to Vegas and they don't even think about the workers. They just think that Vegas is like this party town and they have no conception of who like keeps the town running. But the amount of times that I had people like aggressively chastise me for being out at a casino while pregnant was just incredible.
The ironic thing about that is I actually really loved having sex when I was pregnant.
Oh my God. The orgasms were so amazing.
I know. They're so good. It's like your whole body orgasms and you're like flooded with hormones and you have like twice as much blood. So
yes,
it's just great. So the fact that we desexualize like women when they're like super horny and when sex is really great for them, it's just really a shame.
Hello, this is Chelsea Poe from TroubleFilms.com. I'm here to tell you about getting access to hot BDSM, queer, trans, and dyke porn all in one place. With code Peep Show 21, you can get 21% off your next order from TroubleFilms.com. Again, that's code Peep Show 21, TroubleFilms.com.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so another parallel that's interesting is like sex while pregnant is obviously not for procreative purposes, just like money is not. And I think a lot of the stigma around mothers and sex work, particularly at the intersection of both, is this idea of sex being anything outside of like a heteronormative, cis male dominated thing.
Like the only reason to have sex when you're pregnant is because you want to.
Yeah.
Because it's something you feel like doing because it's pleasurable. I mean, there's lots of reasons to have sex, but I mean, like, it strips, you're right, it totally strips away the procreative aspect of it.
Yeah, like the heteronormative imperative of procreation.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a really, really interesting point. Yeah. And, you know, I camped when I was pregnant and not a ton because I also had a job and it's exhausting to have a job and be pregnant. But, I had a non-camming job, but I did cam when I was pregnant. And that was a really interesting experience because unlike the brothel owner that you were dealing with or manager, whoever it was, I found that the customers were like not super like fetishy. They were actually like very nostalgic. Yeah, it was a really interesting experience because so many of the people who would like come into my cam room would say things like, oh, you look so pretty. Oh, I remember like lying next to my wife when she was pregnant. Oh, that was such a special time in our life. Like, oh, I miss feeling a baby kick, like all kinds of things like that I didn't expect at all.
That's wild. That is so interesting.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting too. We interviewed, I can't remember if just I did or if PJ and I did. It might have just been me. Maxine Holloway, about when she was pregnant, about doing sex work and being pregnant. And one of the things that she was saying that I thought was interesting is that she would have both for like digital stuff, but also with full service stuff, that she would have that experience. And then she would also have like customers who didn't think that they would ever have kids, like who had decided for some reason they weren't going to have any, that just wanted to feel what it was like to be with somebody with like a pregnant body, but also in this sort of like, oh, I want to experience that and I'm not going to actually experience it in my life. I thought that was really interesting too.
Huh. Fascinating.
Yeah. She also said she had some young people, like really young, like her demographic skewed much younger when she was pregnant. And suddenly she would have like clients in their like 20s who were just like wanted to be with a pregnant woman.
God, humans are just wild creatures.
but none of it was what the person that you were working with was saying. You know, none of it was like, oh, I have some attraction to children, or, you know, it was much more like, what is it like to experience, you know, either like looking back nostalgically at their own experiences, you know, when they had kids, or just wanting to know like what a pregnant body is like and how a pregnant body responds sexually and things like that.
Right. I think, you know, I don't know. Maybe our kind of demographic of clientele are a little different. Little rough on the edges as my clients. But another thing that was interesting was when I moved back to Nebraska from Nevada, and had my baby and was breastfeeding, I was trying to sell my breast milk like as a fetish. And this is when Craigslist had been shut down and where you could still sell shit, erotic shit on Craigslist. And what I found fascinating was that there was like somebody in Nebraska it had to have been every waking moment of their fucking lives looking on Craigslist for inappropriate stuff, because it was like as soon as I made my ad as a like for breast milk as a fetish, it was flagged within 5 minutes. Like somebody. It's like, who the fuck is sitting at home scouring Craigslist for breast milk fetish. Just to report it. Like, fuck you, man.
Yeah, so did you not, were you not able to do that?
I was not. My ad got shut down so many times. I did have one person who we kind of started, my partner at the time and I started a kind of relationship with, and things got a little weird. We could use Foucault to try to understand the Midwest's repression of sexuality and how that leads to like an obsession. I never found a client. I think that the brothel situation probably would have felt the best to me, to be honest. But after moving back to the Midwest, the only people that I could find that were interested in this kind of commodification of my pregnant body and then the commodification of my breast milk, they actually kind of scared me.
That's interesting.
Yeah. There was one guy who wanted a pregnant set. He wanted me to like be a sub, which is not inherently scary, obviously.
Yeah.
I've done sub work before, but the way that
totally depends on what they want and what they mean by that, though.
Well, right. And this was all like, I'm going to dictate when you feed your baby and if I want access to your breast milk. Like, it was a whole new world.
Because that's not even about you. That's also, they want to sub your baby, and that's weird.
Yeah. But I think that's demographic. Like, I think that is the result of Nebraska. It's the result of, like, when you're in such a repressed place.
Yeah.
And this is true of criminalization. Like, when you criminalize and repress, it's always going to be I'm sorry, this is probably not politically correct, but it's always going to be the fucking weirdos that are the ones able to rear their ugly heads.
Yeah.
And no, you're not going to dictate whether or not I breastfeed my child. Thank you.
No, absolutely not.
But anyway, wow. I guess that was...
This is why I love talking to, sex workers, because I think it's really interesting because it is like so varied and people have like such different types of experiences based on where they are and how people perceive them and so many different things, age and race and class. And you can't talk about sex work as if it is like an experience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I, thinking about this one guy who wanted to dictate when I breastfed my own child, like clearly he's an asshole. And I think that people will hear that story and be like, oh, at least some people where I live anyway, would hear that story and be like, well, see, that's why the sex industry needs to be criminalized. And I just don't understand that perspective at all.
Like, no.
Clearly, like this story to me is clearly an example of why sex workers need rights.
Right. You know? Yeah. Or why you should be able to put it out on Craigslist, because then you can sift through and see like, I don't want to work with that guy. I want to work with somebody who instead is just interested in, something else that's not controlling my baby's food intake.
And obviously there's privilege with being able to choose one's clients and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that at the end of the day, the kind of gray area to kind of come full circle, but this gray area of like, I've had clients that suck. I still deserve rights.
Yeah. You know? Right.
Why is sex work the only job on the fucking planet where you have to first be liberated in order to be deserving of labor rights? Like, that is so backwards.
Yeah. No, it's completely backwards. Yeah. And there is a lot of privilege with that. But I also, with being able to choose which clients you want to work with. But I also think that the fact that, criminalization and stigmatization makes it so difficult to even advertise your services, like just contributes to that problem.
Oh, total. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. All of this stuff is like very complicated. So that's like a lot of what you're talking about is about much more like the early stages or being pregnant or having a baby. Like, how do you feel like being, a mother like year after year, like impacts your feelings about like sex work or the way in which like, I don't even know, actually, I'm just kind of curious, like in a very open way, like how you're thinking about motherhood now that you have an older kid.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I know that you have older kids too, so I love talking to you about this. But I mean, it is wild. It's confusing at times. I have a pole. We have a very small house, and I have a pole in my house.
Do you?
Yeah.
Did you used to dance?
Oh, yeah. I was a dancer, a stripper before anything.
Okay. That was your first sex work job.
That was my first sex
work job. Okay. I read that now that I forgot that. Yeah.
And actually in the town where I now live is where I started. But, you know, I've made content with this pole, but just, you know, I mean, I like pole dancing. So I have this pole, and I'm not very good at pole dancing. I just like it. And it's good exercise. Yeah. And my, you know, since quarantine began, it's like, what the hell do I do with my child all day? And she enjoys this pole. And that's like a really complicated thing for me. You know, like I'll say things to her like, you know, I used to dance on this pole as a job. And she's like, yeah, whatever. Like she doesn't care at all.
Yeah.
And I try, and I feel like this like overwhelming need to desexualize the pole. Like, oh, isn't this fun? It's like a fireman pole, you know?
Yeah. Like, or like the gymnastics bar or something. Yeah.
Yes. Whereas, and here, this speaks to the whole class issue at hand as well. Like women who do pole dancing for fitness, right? Like they would never have the shame and stigma that comes along with being a, you know, former stripper, former escort, somebody who still slings nudes occasionally. And, you know, like they,
yeah.
They have none of that baggage with them. So I think that the baggage that I carry, which obviously is like internalized whorephobia and stuff, but it's real. I mean, internalized whorephobia is the product of being fucked over so many times versus having the audacity to survive.
Right.
So I struggle in my motherhood with that, but I try not to let her see that because I never want her to think that I am ashamed. I'm not ashamed. Right. I have baggage. I'm not ashamed though.
Mm-hmm. I think that's hard because as they get older, their questions become like more complicated too. I was talking to Jet Setting Jasmine and King Noir, who are parents, like on the podcast recently. And we were talking about questions like our kids ask. And I was telling them that one time recently, like my middle kid was like, we were talking about the fact that I told them that I was doing sex work and like different examples of like what that is, not in a explicit way, but you know, like in a, I do this kind of work, blah, blah, blah. And then he brings up, he's like, oh yeah, I remember when you told me that like several years ago. And I wondered like, so when you do, and he was talking about phone sex, like in particular at this point, he was like, when you do phone sex, does that mean that you like open the receiver and then like you and PJ have sex and they let you listen? And I'm like, what? I mean, I didn't say it like that, but I was like, oh my God, like, no, I don't want to have this conversation because that's a little too specific. And like, and it's not, I mean, and that's usually not what that looks like too. But like, even if it was, like, there's something suddenly about like, do I actually talk about what this looks like or speak about it in like totally vague generalities? And it's hard to like make those choices, I think.
It is. And it's not just like having the sex talk like other parents have. Like my child the other day picked up one of my mentor's books. I went to grad school in Las Vegas and my mentor, Barb Brentz, wrote a book called Sex for Sale. And so my kid the other day pulls this book off the shelf and she goes, Mom, what is sex for sale? Like, wow, that's a loaded question. But it's like, well, you know what sex is, right? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, well, it's when people exchange that for something else that they need. And
yeah,
I think, you know, she's six, so your kiddo's much older.
And
like you said, those conversations become more complicated. But at some level, you know, I guess part of me is like, yeah, parents have sex,
right?
You know? Mm-hmm. And the reasons why we have sex are going to be different and contextual and
right.
But it's
I remember being young though. I totally remember sex not making any sense to me and like being told mechanically like how you do it and having it not occur to me until much later that like that was something that people also did because it was like fun or they got something else out of it. So it's hard for me to imagine that like that would have made sense to me, but maybe it's also because I grew up in a different, like I didn't have parents who were sex workers. So like the conversations around sex also looked like very different. So I don't know. It's like, you have to think about like, what can they understand?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think our children are growing up in much different households than
yeah.
I did. I remember I got caught giving a blowjob when Bill Clinton was president, and my mom threw a stack of dishes at me and asked me who I thought I was. Who do you think you are, Bill Clinton?
Oh, my God. That's so funny. We were talking about Bill Clinton the other day because we were talking about Trump's impeachment and our son was like asking us what impeachment means and like how that works and like why we're impeaching a president that's already not president anymore. So we're like trying to like explain this. And then I was like, you know, it's weird to think that like the last time we did this, it was for a blowjob.
Right?
He's like, what? I mean, Trump was obviously already impeached before this impeachment, but like, you know, to try to explain to him that, and he was like, wait, but what? like, yeah. But I was in high school when that happened. And that was a big deal then. Everybody was like in a moral panic. And I know technically it's because he lied, but he lied about a blowjob, which isn't anyone's business.
Yeah. I do enjoy reading Monica Lewinsky's writing these days. I mean, she's pretty interesting. She talks about the sexism inherent and how all of that shit went down. And
yeah. Can you imagine being her? She was so young when all of that happened.
So young.
Yeah. She's funny on Twitter too.
She is. But yeah, I mean, so that brings up a lot of questions about consent and liberation and exploitation. I mean, again, looking
absolutely, yeah,
back
I wasn't meaning to make light of like president, like.
No, I know.
Yeah,
for sure. But like, just the like to isolate the act of a blow, like the fact that a blowjob, but then we could drive into the complexity of Monica Lewinsky and her age and stuff, but
right.
I mean, everything is complicated. And, you know, I think when I first started doing sex work, I remember this kind of compulsion to identify as liberated.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, I think, you know, I was pushing back on people who insisted that I was being exploited. I was actually looking at an old journal the other day, and apparently I was like dating this guy at the time that I first sold sex. And he was, I don't remember this at all, but he was apparently a women's studies major. So a male feminist. Uh-huh. And apparently he broke up with me after he found out that I had sold sex to,
customer
at the strip club. And his reason was because he didn't want, he couldn't live in a world where women sold sex.
And what?
And so, I mean,
interesting.
I think, like, when I first started doing sex work, my compulsion was to vehemently resist that. Fuck you.
I mean,
whatever.
It makes sense because, I mean, going back to what we were talking about earlier, we get like pushed into defending things that, like, we don't even necessarily want to defend, but like there's such a reaction on the other side of it that it becomes, I don't know. I think it just becomes the better option.
Totally. But I think, so it's just interesting to think back on, like, I definitely would not describe experiences that I described as liberatory then, I would not describe as liberatory now. And I think that some of the things that made my labor difficult were because I didn't have like this basic foundation and this basic like language for talking about consent. And I learned that, I mean, you have to learn quick in the sex industry and you learn quick how to have those conversations. But so I think that any kind of exploitation that happens in the sex industry is such a complicated web of social class, race, all of these intersectional identities, of course, but also it's related to this larger issue of like not allowing people language and narrative to describe what consent means for them.
Right.
Restricting them from that language so that they don't know what consent means for their own self and their own body.
Right. Yeah. And so they also don't have necessarily like, you know, a power analysis to be able to break down, like, consent isn't just being like forced to do something. It's also wrapped up in like the sort of choices that we have or don't have, what other options, you know, are available, how we weigh out very complicated conflicts, you know, how we weigh out the sort of things that we're trying to balance in our lives and what forces are at work there.
And knowing the outcome, you know, I think about this peep show that I worked at in Arizona. And I don't know if you had this experience when you first started doing sex work, but like when I first started, I would do things without discussing prices because I thought that was rude. So I would just like, you know, so I remember working at this peep show and letting this fucking guy jerk off, like, you weren't supposed to jerk off like right in front of the performer, but I let him do it because I was like, oh, he's clearly going to compensate me extra for this, which he fucking, of course, did not.
Right.
And so again, like consent can, like conversations about consent can also include conversations about compensation. And, that is the part that makes a lot of self-proclaimed feminists uncomfortable, because consent is supposed to always be something that happens outside of commodification, which is just fucking bullshit.
Because it's so stupid. Yeah.
The only people that feel that way are people who already have money.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I totally agree with you. I also think that, I don't know, the way I do business now in sex work is so different than the way that I used to do it when I was afraid to talk about prices, when I did think that, when I didn't understand that people who will like suck all of your energy, you know, you should get rid of because other people will be around. You know, there was so many things that like I did out of like fear or nervousness that like 6 years into this, I like don't do anymore.
Totally.
But you have to learn that. You just have to learn it. It's not something that's intuitive and it's not something that's taught in our culture.
I think being a menopausal person, like being in a menopausal body, is interesting too. I think menopause is a superpower. It's a struggle for sure, but it, I just give no fucks anymore. Like, I am not here for anybody's bullshit. Not that I ever gave any fucks before, but I really give any fucks now. And men in particular, you know, cis men, I am just like, listen, I will not give you one iota of my energy for free because you do not deserve it.
Yeah. And I don't actually know. I don't think I'm in a menopausal body. I don't know because I have an IUD that like made my periods go away 4 years ago. But like I don't have that, but I do have, after, you know, spending lots and lots of time like in the sex industry and talking to a bajillion like men and recognizing all of these patterns, like I just don't like care the way that I used to if they like me or not.
Right.
You know, I think there was like, and I think girls and women in particular, like, are trained you know, to care if everybody likes them. And that sort of coming to terms with your own like worth, there is something I think that's, I don't know if I would use the word liberatory, but there is something that's powerful. I would say that there is something that's like powerful about that.
Oh, totally. I like that word better for sure. Powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. To just like figure out that what it is that you have to offer and knowing what it's worth and knowing what's not worth your time and energy. And
definitely.
Especially because in the sex industry, the people who spend the most amount of money the quickest are also usually the ones that cause the most amount of problems.
I think that cis men also need to interrogate. I remember this guy on Twitter said something like, he said that I was a lesbian because no men want to fuck me. And it just struck me.
What?
I mean, clearly that's funny because it's like, no, I'm a lesbian because I don't want to fuck you. But I, but the idea, like in his mind, the idea that having sex with him would be something that I would be like dying to experience is so funny to me. Like, you literally think that the epitome of joy for me is to have sex with you. It's just so funny.
Well, it's also funny that he would assume that like there aren't men who want to have sex with you. That's also bizarre.
I know, right? There's tons of men that want to have sex with me.
Of course there are.
I probably shouldn't be critiquing the whole of our society based on like Twitter comments, but it's funny anyway. Oh,
yeah.
I will say, you know, a final interesting piece of all of this, being an outspoken person, we kind of talked about at the beginning of the show with my family, and I've been very publicly supportive of Black Lives Matter and decrying the racism and white supremacy of my family. And in many of the messages that I've received from my now disowned family, the word whore is used like as
an Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah.
And it's just so fascinating to me that whore is like, I mean, I have a scar, like a legit scarlet letter, but also whore as like narrative and rhetoric is a stand-in for all non-normative femininity.
Right.
And when you live in a white supremacy, part of a non-normative femininity is to decry white supremacy as a white woman. And so that I just found that rather fascinating as well.
It is, I think, that and to assume that that's a bigger problem than white supremacy also like mind-boggling to me.
But that, I mean, so I don't know if you know Brittany Cooper's work. She's one of my faves, but she had, do you remember when that, this was years ago, there was like a pool party and that young woman was like pulled to the ground by a cop in a bathing suit. And Brittany Cooper wrote about it. And I love this piece. I can't remember the title, but I can send it to you if you're interested. But anyway, Brittany Cooper wrote in this piece talking about this, this pool party with this young Black woman who got thrown on the ground by this white cop. Brittany Cooper wrote, the protection of white womanhood animates the core of so much aggression against Black bodies, because it was white women at this pool who had called the cops. And that, I mean, that will stick with me till the end of my time on this
planet. Right. Yeah. And,
you know, and I think that that is at the heart of a lot of anti-sex work sentiment is the preservation of white supremacist ideas of what femininity is and should be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the interesting thing about this is that all of this uptick in concern about trafficking is also like underwritten by this this like intense desire to protect white women. And I think that the like inherent like racism of that needs to be pulled out.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. It's really sick, you know, and I,
yeah, it really is.
One thing as a sociologist that I really try to stress to my students is like social processes are not, we're not conscious of
right.
all the time, you know, like I use the idea of a stop sign, you know, you know what a stop sign is, but you cannot pinpoint the moment that you learned what it was because it's
right.
always been this social construct that has always been present in your life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the same is true for ideologies of femininity and white supremacist ideologies, particularly.
Yeah.
You know, we don't do these things consciously all the time. They're so embedded
right.
in society, which as a white woman, I'm, you know, I'm not the person to speak to this, but there you have it.
Yeah. No, but I think it is important to talk about that. And I think it is important to like talk about these assumptions that we have about sex workers, the assumptions that we have about what trafficking is and who's trafficked or who's exploited in these jobs and who's not. I think that looking at like where those ideas came from and like calling them out for being like embedded in white supremacy, I think that's really, it's really important.
Totally. And we saw the same thing happening at the turn of the century in London. You know, there was like this influx of Eastern European migrants and racist white people lost their shit and started these kind of yellow journalistic accounts of young white girls being sold into white slavery.
Right, right. Yeah, well, we should probably wrap up. Do you want to say anything else about like the work that you're doing with Feminist Press or your book that's coming out?
Sure. I will just say, if Gillian Anderson is listening to Peep Show Podcast, I would like her to know that I am in love with her and she is in an open relationship. I am here. Call me.
Did you watch her in Sex Education?
Yes. What? Oh my God. She's so hot. Oh my God.
She's also like the hot mom who asserts her own like sexuality in that show.
Yeah, totally. Oh my God. See, Jillian, I'm telling you, we've got something here.
You never know. You never know.
I know. So I'm hoping that the new book, which is basically all about the X-Files and Gillian Anderson and sex work, will be out in 2022. And I just really appreciate being in this anthology with you and all of the other amazing people that were part of this book. I just feel really grateful. So, and also grateful to be on Peep Show.
Okay. Thank you. I feel grateful to have, you know, to be able to chat with you again.
I need a new coffee mug, by the way.
Oh, I'll send you one.
Will you?
Yeah, I will.
I used mine so much I broke it.
I'll send you another one.
Yay, thank you.
Yeah, it was really great to talk to you. Where can people find your work?
So great to talk to you too. I am on Twitter at Juniper Fitz. And I've got publications on Vice and Broadly and Pacific Standard and Yahoo News and this new anthology of We Too, the children's book, How Mamas Love Their Babies. You should check that out.
And I loved that. I taught it to one of my classes. I taught when I was still teaching classes and they loved it. They all bought it and they brought it to class and we did like a story hour. It was very cool.
Oh my God. Thank you so much.
Did I never tell you that?
I don't think so. I love that.
Yeah, no, it was really great. And they pointed out so many things about the book. The book was really powerful to them.
Oh, that warms my heart. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So thank you for chatting with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Peep Show Podcast. I'm PJ Sage, and you can find me on Twitter at PJ Sage.
And I'm Jesse Sage, and you can find me on Twitter at sapiotextual or at jessesage.com.
We would like to remind you that we have a Patreon account and would appreciate your support. Please visit patreon.com/peepshowpodcast. Our music is courtesy of Joe Kennedy. The show was produced by Jesse and PJ Sage.
Signing off. Have a great week.